If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-covid-19. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to the October 14th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show, we're presenting two half-hour documentaries on the Canadian residential school crisis, one that was produced by CFRC and the other by CFRO, both campus community radio stations. So without further ado, here they are.
Welcome back. My name is Dana, and in the first half of this documentary, I shared a little bit about my own experience related to adoption in the Aboriginal community, being a Cree woman and having a sister who was also Aboriginal that was adopted into our family. I then brought you through the experiences of two Aboriginal women in Kingston, Ontario, who had connections to the 60s scoop, and how listening to them has helped me to realize that adoption within the Aboriginal community is a common story, even though it is often kept in the shadows. And while there are thousands of Aboriginal people that have stories related to the 60s scoop, the story of Aboriginal people and adoption is further complicated by those who have experiences with voluntary adoption. In the next half hour, you will hear the stories of two Aboriginal women whose stories have helped me to come to terms with my distant relationship with my sister who was adopted. I wanted to include their stories in this documentary because their stories are seemingly more rare than the narrative of the 60s scoop, as they have to do with voluntary surrender as well as internation adoption. Both of these women work in Kingston, Ontario, and are from Tandanega Mohawk Territory. First, I want you to hear the story of Dearunya Yondris, whom I met through her work within the Aboriginal community in Kingston. I have known her for a few years and realized that I didn't know much at all about her adoption story, only that which she ever mentioned in passing. The following is what she had to share about her adoption into a nearby Mohawk community and what she has learned over the years about family and community.
Sego, Dearunya Yondris Yungats, ni Degayanda nega ni gidero, what square again it's good any wagate the world on. Dano Laura America ne Johansa Gasana. So I introduced myself in my language, Mohawk first, and what I said was my Mohawk name is Dearunya Yondris. And it means she recognizes two skies. And I live in Tandanega. And I stated that I sit with the Bear Clan and that my English name is Laura Miracle. I work at Four Directions Aboriginal Student Centre as the Aboriginal Student Success Strategist. So basically, the Aboriginal advisor and I work hand in hand to make sure that the Indigenous students at Queen's have all the support that they need. Well, I'm personally connected as I was, my biological father was adopted, who I never met, and so my connection and story about how that affected me and affected my experiences within my life path, but also I was adopted as well. My siblings and I have the same biological mother, but we have different fathers, and I was legally adopted, and so that's what I can bring to that. But also, I As doing student support, I have come across students who have a similar story as mine, but also who's been affected by adoption through, and I'm finding it's more commonly through our parents' generation, so the one that come before us, and adoption was very significant there. So I would say I'm connected through my life path in my community, also through my job and personally. My biological father was a product of the 60s scoop. Well, he wasn't directly, his brothers and sisters were, so he didn't grow up with his siblings, and his mother hid him under the bed, and so that's how he didn't get scooped. And and then my grandmother, my biological grandmother's from Manitoulin Island, but I don't know specifically what nation, what community on the island she comes from. I have a picture. I don't have much names because my mother didn't know her. She met her once when she was dying in the hospital, and she didn't know who she was or didn't know names or anything like that. So it's been really hard for me to try to find my birth father, his records, so I can be able to trace my lineage on the island. That's really important to me. So I'm hoping one day I'll be able to get past that, where I've just stuck it in the corner and ignored it, but it doesn't go away. So hopefully I'll be able to move through that and be able to seek those out, because I have family out there, and I have half brothers that I don't have and even met. And you feel like there's something missing. It's almost like you spiritually know that you have a connection, a blood connection somewhere, but you can't. But it feels like it's almost like you're a lost soul, right? And I know I've heard many people talk about adoption where they say, you know, they feel like something's missing in their life. And that's a common factor that no matter what your adoption story is, that's a common pattern or a common statement I hear from that, is you feel like something's missing, at least to the people I've been talking to. So my father was a product of that. And then my mother, when she became pregnant with me, she was a teenager. She was 18. She was outcast. My biological father didn't accept me, or wasn't able to accept me at that time in his life, for the path that he was on. I mean, even though he wasn't part of the scoop and didn't go to residential school, you know, he still was affected by multi-generational trauma, you know, lost in his path with alcohol and drugs. And then he was Anishinaabe, and his best friend was Mohawk. So my mother, after she broke up with my biological father, ended up taking up with his best friend, this Mohawk man who slept on her couch all the time. Unfortunately, you hang out with like people in your circle, and if he was on the path of alcohol and drugs, and so was my father, my adopted father, the one who raised me. So he came into my life when I was about 3. And so then my father legally adopted me. So now I'm legally adopted in the system with this Mohawk man. So, and then I acquired rights as a Mohawk person, even though I didn't have any Mohawk blood within me. But that's how I was raised since I was 3. So the one thing that he did do right, even though he was off his path, was he introduced us to a community, to the community that he was connected to, Tyendinaga. And ever since we were 3, he brought us back and forth to different events and different family events and met different people, so introduced them in our life. So when I did move there, I did have a community. I did have a sense of family. I wasn't just a stranger moving in. I had a family base. I mean, I was a stranger to the people within the community. They didn't know who I was. And so that took about, with some people, it took 10 years for them to even talk to me or accept me. And I had to work in the community for a long time, volunteer, before I would even be able to get a job. Not that I wasn't qualified. I was qualified for a lot of the jobs there. But being born and raised in Toronto and moving when I was 22, it took a lot. I had to prove myself within the community before I could gain employment there. And like I said, it took some people 10 years to talk to me. So the best thing that my father did for us was we were able to have rights and privileges as Mohawk children, because he legally adopted us into the system. But it wasn't until I sat with I embraced the concept of peace with the Longhouse people, that's where I had my most transformative learning experiences. As what does it mean to be Ongwehoe, and like what does it mean to be Indian, right, or Mohawk, or you, whatever term that you wanted to use at that day, right? So I just say Ongwehoe in our language, right, which means, you know, Aboriginal people, and refers to us, or Gunyangahaga, you know, speaking a Mohawk person who speaks the language. But I only consider myself on the creator board of learning when it comes to language. But I try, because my children go to immersion schools. Well, one does, but the other one goes to an immersion program. And so having that foundation was the best thing for me. Because that community, the Longhouse community, actually taught me what being community means. Because I knew what the word was, but I didn't know it until I experienced it. So they taught me about community, and they taught me about family, what family really was. You know, the Longhouse community taught me what it's like to conduct yourself in peace, and what it's like to have skin 7 layers thick, you know, and what does peace mean, like about the concepts to conduct yourself as a human being, have an open mind to Gadangurio, to have strength. Gazanstansara, I never say that one right. I always struggle with that word. And then peace, gonna, right? So those, sometimes when I slip, I just remember those. Just remember those three things, Laura. Are you conducting yourself in an open mind? Are you conducting yourself in peace? Are you conducting yourself with strength? And so I don't have any regrets. Yeah, but that's my story, and that's how they've contributed to who I am today. And I still, to this day, will go if they call me. I would say the best thing from my story that helped me was by finding community. And they guided me, and they walked beside me. And they were my eyes and my ears and my mouth and my throat and my voice when I needed them to be, when I didn't have a clear mind. So find out what that community is to you. It doesn't mean you have to be on a reserved territory or in a longhouse or whatever, because not all of us have that option. But whether you're in an urban community or whether you're connected to your family or not, or disconnected, find out what does that mean to you? Who is your community? And create that community and create your support people so that when you are lost and you need to be guided, that you do have people to walk beside you, and not to be ashamed to release, to let that go, right? So you don't have to carry all that heaviness on your shoulder, you know? So yeah, I guess that would be my closing words. And those are just my own personal beliefs and values and teaching. And nobody can take that from me.
Go down. Down by the water, and your back is to the mountains. Lay down and dream of heaven. It's been long.
After hearing De Arunyet Yondris' story, I found myself again thinking about my relationship with my sister. Growing up, I always looked at other siblings and other families and wished that I had had a closer relationship with my sister. We had never really had the same interests and constantly bickered over things that were petty. But when Dayaruniyat Yonderus started talking about community, I started to realize that rather than commiserate over the distance that my sister and I have, that I should appreciate the Aboriginal community around me that has become my second family. You see, I spend a lot of time at the Aboriginal Student Center where Dayaruniyat Yonderus works, and as a result, have really grown in my cultural understanding of what it means to be an Aboriginal person. I have been fortunate enough to attend many cultural ceremonies and consider the staff at the center to be my Mohawk family. I have spent a lot of my life mourning a sisterly relationship that I do not think will ever be possible, and maybe it's unfair of me to expect a relationship out of my sister that will never be. Perhaps I was meant to find this second family to walk beside me as I find peace and acceptance in my relationship with my sister, who I think gives as much love as she knows how. And as Kayla said in her interview, maybe things will never be perfect in our healing, but coming together as a community is always a good start. And that community is what I have found here in Kingston, Ontario. A community that accepts me and loves me. A community that is always there, much like the community that Dayaruniyat Yonderus spoke about. A community for which I would not hesitate to help when they needed it, as much as I know that they would not hesitate to help in my time of need. In the next interview, Ganut Shuni, another woman from Tandinega Mohawk Territory, will talk about her experience of adoption. I also know Ganut Shuni because she works at the same Aboriginal Student Center as Dayaruniyat Yonderus, and also consider her to be part of my Mohawk family. Like Dayaruniyat Yonderus, I knew a little of Ganut Shuni's adoption story, but this is what she had to say about finding out that she had a sister who was secretly adopted outside of her family and of her homecoming 50 years later. You'll be close, you catch your
word, you catch your word. So my real name is Ganut Shuni. Ganut Shuni Yungyets means Ganut Shuni is what I'm called. Wagenyatu, I'm from the Turtle Clan. Kunyunkehaga, I'm from the Mohawk Nation. And Tagayantanega or Gundeke Tkidrono means I'm from Tayandanega. I'm connected with adoption through my sister. My second oldest sister was given up for adoption at birth, so that's how I have an adoption story. Well, we didn't even know my sister existed until about 3 years ago, so I was in my 50s when we found out that we had another sister. There's three of us now, and then we found out there was actually a fourth one. And we were having a family reunion, and my oldest sister, who knew about her, told my younger sister and I we had another sister who'd been given up for adoption. We were both flabbergasted because we had no idea, because that kind of thing just wasn't done in our family. And so she told me, and I told my youngest sister, and then we decided to try and find her. So my youngest sister went and registered with Family Services, or Children's Aid, or whatever it's called, and started a search. Now, in order to find her, she had to be searching too, because that's the only way that they can do a match. And that was in August. And then in November, they called my little sister and said they needed a copy of her long-form birth registration, because that's how they match you with a parent. And then in June, she got a letter from Children's Aid saying, "We found a match. This is her name, this is her address, and this is her phone number." And that's all the letter said. And they said they'd sent her a letter also saying, "We found a match," because she had also been searching, and that was the only way they found each other. And her letter said, "We found a match. This is the name, the address, and the phone number." And that's all they say. And I think that's very brutal. But so I was actually at a big event in Toronto and had to do public speaking, and my little sister called screaming on the telephone and said, "I've got a letter, they found her, what'll I do?" And I just said, call her. So she called, and call me right back. So she called her, and then she called me right back immediately, and I thought, wow, that was quick. But here she got an answering machine, so she said I couldn't really leave a message. I said, no, that wouldn't have been a good idea. So I said, well, keep trying and call me back later. I'll call you back later. So I had to go do my thing. And then I phoned her back again, and she had gotten in touch with her. And when she answered the phone, she asked if that was her. And she said, my little sister said, "I don't know any other way to tell you this except to say that I'm your sister." And our sister said, "Oh my God." So she started asking questions like, "What's your name? What was our mother's name? Where was I born?" All those kinds of things to clarify that they were actually really sisters. And my adoptive sister knew there was one sibling. She didn't know if it was a boy or a girl because that's all it had on her papers from Children's Aid. So she didn't know there was three of us and that we were all sisters. And the family who adopted her, she stayed with them her whole life. They adopted her as a baby, and she said she had a happy life with them, but she only had her and then one brother. They had one biological child who was a boy. And so she said all her life growing up, all she wanted was to have a sister. But when my youngest sister was talking to her, she said to her, "Well, if you ever want to come to visit, you have a place to stay here." And they had their conversation, and then about, I think, a day or two later, she called back and said, "Were you serious about having us come and stay?" And my little sister said, "Yeah." She said, "We'll be there on July 1st. And this was already into June. So we all got excited, and the whole family got excited, and we started making plans, and she and her husband came. July 1st, they arrived. We now call that Sister's Day, but it was also her wedding anniversary. So it was her 40th wedding anniversary, and now it's Sister's Day. So she came into the house, and we were all screaming and crying and hugging, and we couldn't believe it. And she had brought pictures of her family, her children and her husband and her grandchildren, and we all had our pictures out so we could teach her about us and about each other, right? So we could share our lives and get to know each other. And the amazing thing was, to me, I thought she looks more like our mother than any of us do. And she hadn't been with us, you know, or before. And then there was that thing she said about all she ever wanted was a sister, and now she had three of us. And the other thing she said that really impacted us was all her life growing up, all she wanted was to have people who looked like her. There never was anybody who looked like her in her family until she had her children. And then when she walked into the house that day, and we all look alike. I mean, especially those three of them, my oldest, two oldest sisters, and my youngest sister, they look a lot alike. So you could really see the resemblance. So it was like it had an immediate impact because there was no doubt that she was our sister and we were all related. On her adoption papers, they had told her she had a trace of Indian blood. So she didn't know even that she was Mohawk. And when she told my little sister, that's what her papers said, is that she had a trace of Indian blood. My little sister said, "Bullshit." She said, "You're Mohawk in your Turtle Clan. You know, there's no trace. You're Mohawk in your Turtle Clan. Because in our culture, you are what your mother is. And our mother was Mohawk and our mother was Turtle Clan. So that's what she is too. That's what we all are." Right off the bat, she came and she started going to Longhouse. And so she made a connection with the Longhouse community, and she started learning about her culture and our traditions right away. And she's come, like she's made several visits, and her son actually and his family have come to see the territory and to visit all of us and to meet all of us. So I guess, yeah, it didn't really change my idea of family. What it did change was my understanding of my mother, because understanding the pain that she went through, having to give that baby up for whatever reason and living with that as a secret her whole life because we never knew of it while she was alive. It was her secret that she carried. And then learning about how that came to be and how it all happened through my oldest sister, but also through my mother's cousin, who was like one of her best friends and knew the story and thankfully was still alive when we found her, so that we could all go and talk to her and hear the story from her, because she was really close. And so she knew that story, but it was a painful story and it was a very hard, distressing story. I mean, thinking about it as a woman and as a mother, what she had to go through to give that baby up is heartbreaking. And then knowing that she had to live with it for the rest of her life. And knowing that she used to say, "I would walk down the street in town and look inside of every baby carriage to see if there was a little blonde-haired baby in the carriage to look and see if it was my baby. And every day I wondered if she was safe and happy. I mean, for me personally, there was healing around my relationship and understanding of my mother, knowing this part of her life that I didn't know about before. And it helps me to understand how she was as a mother to us and as a woman, because she wasn't always present. But you know, when you've had to have that kind of separation, she lived her whole life with grief, right? And shame, probably, because it happened in the 40s. So that was a time when this kind of thing wasn't acceptable. And so knowing all of that helped me understand her better as a human being, and helped me have more empathy towards her, I guess, and understanding. But I think as a family, then we healed because there wasn't this big gaping secret that just one of us knew about and the rest of us didn't know about. And since we came out with the fact that we had a sister who had been adopted out, but that we've brought her home, we've had a lot of other families come forward and say, you know, there was somebody in our family that was given up for adoption and we haven't found them or whatever, or there's fear around it. And I guess my thing would be encouraging words, because that's what we do, right? In our longhouse, it's all about encouraging words. So my encouraging words would be, at the end of the day, they're family. And family, in my understanding of things, family is the most important thing. So regardless of what happened up until this point, what's important is what happens from this point forward. And that means bringing family home.
Ganas Chuni's words really touched my heart. I thought of how grateful that I am to have had my sister in my life since I was born. I am grateful that I continue to have my sister in my life, despite our relationship not being how I imagined sisters should be. Ganas Chuni's sister's homecoming and reconnection with family and Mohawk culture is not a story that is often pictured as part of the topic of Aboriginal people and adoption. However, the secrecy of adoption is still a theme that runs through all of the stories that we've heard in this documentary. And while Ganas Chuni's mother gave her sister up for adoption voluntarily, it was still kept a secret from the rest of the family for over 50 years. It was only after finding her sister and being very open about her return that Ganas Chuni and her family found healing. And I think that the wider Aboriginal community can also find healing in being open about stories about adoption and other experiences with the child welfare system. In sharing our stories with one another as Aboriginal people, especially about a topic that is often met with silence, we can only make our communities stronger and move forward on a path of collective healing. In closing, I'd like to thank Beth, Kayla, Deirunyat Yonderis, and Ganas Chuni for kindly sharing their stories with me for this project. I couldn't be more thankful for their contributions, as I feel as though I have also healed through my journey in creating this documentary. Thank you for listening to this Resonating Reconciliation documentary, a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. It is made possible through the support of the Red Jam Slam Society and funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. We recognize that you may be triggered by the content of this documentary, and we apologize for any profanity. If listeners need support, the Indian Residential Schools Resolutions Health Support Program Crisis Line can be reached 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for immediate emotional assistance at 1-866-925-4419. Listeners can also find out more information about the Indian Residential Schools Resolution Health Support Program in Ontario by calling 1-888-301-6426 and the teletypewriter at 1-800-267-1245 Health Canada. Thank you again for listening to this Resonating Reconciliation documentary.
Good evening. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. For tonight's edition of Grey Matters, we're presenting two half-hour documentaries on Canada's residential school crisis, one by CFRC and the other by CFRO, both NCRA campus community radio stations. So here's the second documentary, Residing Reconciliation, produced by CFRO.
This documentary is a project of the National Community Radio Association. It is made possible through the support of the Red Jam Slab Society. It is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. There's a national crises line should any listeners be triggered by what they hear on this program today. The number is 1-866-925-4419.
I don't even say what I went through, but it hurts. And do you know that, you know, it's very, very sad how we were treated down here. I see the impact out there with the other survivors, and some of them don't even make it to get in their settlement. And it's sad that, you know, we're the first ones on this land. And, you know, it's sad that we have to see everybody down here on Skid Row. And it was out there, too, and when I was using, and this guy kept falling around crying, and you could tell that he was wanted attention. He was going into a seizure, and then I didn't want to be close to him. I crossed the street, and he followed me, and he was just looking up. He said, "Oh God, it hurts so much inside," he said. And then I just looked at him. I said, "I know what you're going through." I said, "You're going through that depression. You feel like nobody loves you, nobody cares." And he just stared at me, and he asked me if I could have a hug. He said, "I never seen him again," and that's how I imagine how everybody feels.
In 2008, the government of Canada made an apology and asked for forgiveness from 150,000 children, now called survivors of residential schools. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, now nearing its end, has initiated the dialogue required to seek answers on how to help survivors affected by residential schools and facilitate healing needed. Born out of the TRC is Reconciliation Canada, the organization assigned to continue the reconciliation process. All Aboriginals are in some way afflicted by the residential school experience, and for the past 35 years, in the downtown east side of Vancouver, the Women's Center has assisted women and children with outreach, advocacy, housing, skills development, and wellness programs, where over the last 50 years, cases across Canada of missing and murdered women continue unsolved. Child apprehension and ministry care soars. We have asked a group of elders from the Women's Center to lighten their burden of memories that sear into their daily lives. They are survivors, second generation, or were raised within foster families. Here, they tell their residential school experience, their stories of loss, displacement, and marginalization, but also to give insight to the reconciliation needed in Canada. You've heard B. Here are Veronica, Rita, Stella, Bernie, Faye, and Carol.
I'm Veronica. I have a colonizer's last name, Butler. And I'm originally from Great Lake Huron in Ontario. I'm not a residential school survivor. Family members, my siblings are. I have a little bit of a different story in that, not just a story, but my history and my family are greatly impacted by the experience of residential school.
Hello, my name is Rita Blind. And originally from Saskatchewan, and I've been in Vancouver for 40, maybe 41 years now. And how I ended up here was because of violence in my life, in my marriage, and both of us, my husband and I, were both children out of the residential school. So that really had a great effect, you know, how we lived.
Hi, my name is Stella August. A Housing Band member from the west coast of Vancouver Island, but I've been on the mainland for over 40 years. We have a big effect from the residential school. My family's all gone, and I went to school in Christie School on Vancouver Island and Mission City on the mainland here. Yes, I have things to say about the residential school.
Good afternoon. My name is Bernice Verdi. I'm a survivor of the residential school. Although I was only there for 1 year, the post-traumatic stress outweighs a lot of what I have heard over the years from the survivors, people that have grown up in the system since they're 5 and 7 years old. So I have a long story, even though I only went 1 year. And that's all it took to destroy my healthy 13-year-old mind.
My name is Faye Blaney. I'm from Homachku First Nation. It's the northernmost of the Coast Salish. There are 4 generations in my family that went to residential school. I'm the first generation to raise my own 2 children. I went to Seashelt, and I went to St. Mary's. Everybody grew up with sexual abuse in our community, I think, and I did. My earliest memory of being abused by my great-grandfather was when I was 3, I think. And I remember my great-grandmother getting really angry with me. I don't know if she thought I was flirting with my great-grandfather or what it was, but she got mad at me, and I was just 3. I didn't know what was going on.
Okay, I didn't go to residential school, but I can tell you for sure that I sure felt the impact. My name is Carol Martin. That's my Canadian name. I was born in a small reserve called Hazleton. And as I understand, the Gitxsan people really held on to their kids, and some of them didn't get sent to residential school. I was also brought up in a small reserve called King Kolith up the Nass River. I grew up with a lot of our knowledge of the, you know, the roots of my people. My grandfather refused to speak English. Those were one of the happiest times of my life ever, was with my grandparents in King Kolith, because they taught me about community. They taught me about what it meant to be a community when we looked after each other. You know, we went to the mountains, we collected wild tea, we knew the roots, we were so connected to Mother Earth. You weren't afraid to go walk into the forest. You, like, everybody knew you, but there was also that dark side that I didn't understand. And as a young child, I didn't know a lot of what was taking place, but I sure knew that everything that happened behind closed doors stayed behind closed doors. And this is what I grew up with.
I come out of the foster care system that was a direct result of what happened to my parents. And both my parents must have gone to residential school, but it was never spoken of. And my mother, who just passed on less than a year ago, never mentioned ever going to residential school. But I do know, having gone myself into a foster care system, that's the direct result of what happens with residential school. And I see it so much among the community here. I've been in Vancouver here 34 years. My early couple of years here, I got a job as a Native youth street worker, and one of my jobs was sitting over at the bus depot on Dunsmuir back in that day and waiting for young Indian children to be released from foster care at 16 to 18 with a one-way bus ticket to Vancouver. And I would wait for them there and ask if they had their names and if they had family to come to Vancouver to be with, and then would invite them over to our little project to come in and look in on us and start getting to know, getting to the basics and seeking out their basic necessities and so on in the community here. And that was 1982, and I still see that going on. I don't sit around the bus depot these days, but I do hear a lot of families torn apart and struggling to keep contact with each other's. And that's mothers with their babies. I've just heard that the Aboriginal Mother Center is closing. I just can't. I'm so surprised. I wanted answers and wanted an Aboriginal Mother Center to carry on and for us to learn how to look after our children and look after our elders and look after our history, our languages, our culture. So, with a gentler voice. I'm here to support the elders who are on, and to make success at every little effort that an elder chooses to make. I'll go right to my last breath to make the little movement that an elder wants to make. I'll make it a success. I'll keep going that distance because I know there's future generations that will come along, and that they will know that there never has to be another residential school, because they'll know that history.
And Sunday, comes walking in. The kids were playing outside. It was like about this time in the afternoon. Comes into the bedroom. Who are you? I said I was home. And he came in and just pushed me right on the bed. I don't know where I got that strength, but I came right up. And in my head, I said, no more, no more. And I pushed him as hard as I could. And he kind of went, and I said, ever touch me again. Don't ever touch me again. And I looked at him in the eyes, and he knew I meant it. And I went over, my baby was over there, and I started putting my baby's coat, and I just took him, and he said, where are you going? I said, never mind. I walked out of that place, and I went to the police station just right here in Vancouver, just right here. And that was the last. I said, no more. I had enough. Because I was sore, beatings from my legs, my body, my whole body, sometimes my whole face. But I said, no more. And I said, Creator, I can't do this no more. I know you said that we're Catholics and we're not supposed to divorce, we're not supposed to, but I can't live like this, Creator. Please, forgive me, but I can't live with him no more. I said, I'm finished. After that little prayer, my whole body went into this hole, like something fell right off of me and it slipped right down. I could feel it almost, what the heck was that? And that was the beginning of my healing, you know. That was 1973. And I said, no more, no more ever anybody gonna beat me up. No more. And we parted. My children, you know, now I'm the boss and everything else, and, you know, I used to scream at my children, get over here, get here, come inside, the top of my voice, and I think about it, the neighbors must have thought I was a wicked person. And I, you know, during that time, I started thinking about myself, you know, and I said, I can't do this to my kids. And I was just, as my sister said, she drank, and so did I. It was one of the things you go and hide, and you know, this alcohol, and freaking. I started drinking alcohol when I was in that residential school because that priest would give me that alcohol so I can't feel nothing. I didn't become an alcoholic there, but I
drank that thing so I don't have to feel anything. But you see, these are the things that our sisters and brothers go through every single day. My parents never knew what I was going through, and I couldn't tell them nothing, even though they were just gentle people. My parents never, they were the kindest people. They were very quiet, and my father was like, he'd do lots of reading. My father loved to read, even though he didn't really go to school, but he loved to read. And my mom was the kindest. You come to visit her right away, she'll set up the table, and without asking, she'll just feed you. And we're going to get back all those things. Our gentleness, our kindness, our love, and our compassion are going to all come back to our people. The way that's happening in this world right now, it's going to stop. The government thinks they got us. I don't think so. Your money and everything else, that's enough. Our people will stand. When they stand, they're standing already, and they're coming into their own power. And when our people, especially the woman, watch out. And I don't mean guns or anything like that. It's going to be through the power of our own humanness as human beings is coming back. And it's when it does, we are going to stand. And we're not going to have anyone from other parts of the world to come and tell us how to live in our own land. It's enough. We pay rent like thousands of dollars every month to pay houses that have been paid over and over and over again. Well, that is going to stop also. You people come into these lands and take over everything. Well, that too is going to stop one way or the other. If it's not us going to do it, the Creator will do it. And it's going to be that way, and there's no other way. Because the kindness and the gentleness of the human race of this whole world is coming forward. And when it does, everything is going to come into gentleness again. And the paradise will return to these lands. And our mother is going to breathe again. We've got to stop raping this land, because it is going to stop. And our people are going to stand up. And I know who we are going to, we're going to heal the land. And our people are going to stand up on the land again. And the earth, once you stand on that earth, you can feel the energy coming up into your head and then back again. And then, so it is going to happen. I know it, because grandfathers and grandmothers have said it in the sweat lodges, and the sweat lodges are getting more powerful. The sun dances, the longhouses. Our people are coming back into life, back into their humanness. Thank you. Thank you.
I know I'm one of the survivors. And it hasn't been an easy life being a survivor, because the scar is deep. The wound has never healed. Because I've been silent all these years. But not now. Not anymore. We survivors need love and respect and appreciation. Because we're human. And I feel, as an adult, I'm still that child. For all these years, I'm 68 years old. I'm still that child growing up from the residential school. Feeling the pain and the suffering that they blessed us with, I guess you could say. Being in the residential school, I was never happy. And then when summer came along, everyone wants to go home for the holidays. But my mama, she never showed up. So the social service stepped in. And I was like the rest of the other children, shuffled around, foster home to foster home. And that was another place where a child could never ever be happy. And these are the scars and the wounds that we grew up with. And the only way that I'm going to get rid of it is by voicing my voice the way I am today, to set myself free. And I hope every one of us survivors feel that way, that we can voice our voices and set ourselves free. Because we need that freedom. We need it bad. We've been little prisoners all our lives, right from the day that we stepped into the residential school. We've never been set free, but we are going to set ourselves free.
My name is Bernice Verdi. I'm Mishka. And this is my niece, Carol. Her and I share the same grandmother. Far too often, and I'm not saying it's all men, but in my homeland, I live with a lot of dictators, male dictators. Some of them are my own grandfathers, my own uncles. They have learned well, so now we have to educate our brown government that they have to leave that white government behind. It's useless to us now. But if the white government is coming to outline how we're going to govern our native people, it's never going to work.
Why should we be making proposals to the government? Maybe it should be the other way around. The government make proposals to us so that they can continue their business on our lands. They're slowly moving in on our reserves. And now we have no housing to go home to because there's more white people on my reserve, East Indians, Chinese, Japanese. I see like maybe about 10 educated people that work in the government and in the schools. And to me, that's very poor in healing. So yes, there's a reason why we're here, is to help our own people to enhance so that we could go home and we could be with our own people.
Everybody in my family went through the independent assessment process, the IAP. It seems like everybody went through that. But I refused to go because I feel so angry about the whole thing. When I got my common experience payment, they ripped me off. 2 years, they were probably the two worst years of my life. And they denied me 2 years. And I wanted to send it back to them because I just thought it was such a slap in the face, you know, for what I went through and for them to deny me those 2 years. But I couldn't because I really needed the money. And it made me feel cheap needing the money. So because of that, I just thought it's such a sham of a process and I don't want to go through the IAP. When the TRC came here in September, that was the first time that I disclosed being molested there in residential school, and I didn't want to go through that process to tell that story. I saw my family go through it. And my first cousin, she was raped by one of the older boys there. They said that they had no opportunity to respond to the situation because she did not go to any of the supervisors there. They had no opportunity to respond to that situation, and so they would not compensate her for that rape. And so the whole process is a joke. I don't like it, and I didn't want to go through it, so I didn't. But it damaged my family so badly, my whole family, and it's just such a challenge to know our culture, to know our language, because, you know, I want that, but I just hate what my community stands for, and I hurt so bad, and I don't want to cry about it today. I've cried for the past 4 or 5 years over what happened to me at home. I went home to work, and the things that I ran away from, they're all there, and they're there in spades. They're there worse now. I think what's really important is for Aboriginal people to have a place in Canadian society. You know, everywhere we go, we're nothing. And it shows with the missing women, the murdered women. It's still going on. In the memorial march this year, I wanted to bring this woman forward, and I couldn't find them before I was speaking. That woman, Melissa, her name is, her sister was killed last month in Montreal. And the same crap that happened here with the police is happening there. That's what reconciliation is dealing with the sexual dysfunction in our communities, the breakup of relationships, the overwhelming number of our children that are in foster care, our lack of access to education. It's all those programs and services and quality of life that we lack as Native people. And here in the downtown east side, I think there's so much work that needs to be done for Native women. We need way more detox beds for women. There needs to be treatment centers just for Native women. We need to have a look at sexually exploited youth, because it seems like the highway to prostituting Native women is just in the fast lane. So I think we need more advocacy around child apprehensions. I think it's not enough that we have the Aboriginal agency that does the apprehending, which is run by non-Aboriginal people. I think we need an agency that advocates for Native moms and Native grandmothers. And we definitely need a livable wage, you know, with how poor people are on welfare. So I'm glad we're on track anyway. At least we're moving forward with this whole notion of reconciliation. There's a lot of resistance coming from the non-Native people, but there are other non-Native people that recognize the importance of it.
Society got very smart, you know. The public inquiry was just set that whole silence. It just validated years of labeling us as Indigenous women as hookers, as prostitutes. That it was very racist, it was biased, everything, stereotype. It just blanket all that years of labels that who we are as Indigenous women. And that's not who we are. You talk about truth and reconciliation, and we'll tell you the truth. It's just that can you stand to hear the truth being told? Can you stand there and listen to my story? And these are not just tears of just, you know, I want attention or something. What is reconciliation? Because after the government states that whole apology to the residential school survivors, he closed down, 145 programs across Canada. It's like, where is that? Why is it that I'm being censored and monitored when I speak, when I'm telling you the truth? We've always been trying to adapt to this white system. Isn't it time that people see us as a very unique and very resilient group that have survived years of genocide? You know, the illness, the sickness, and what continues right now? You know, the missing and murdered women. What of that? Our children are still being stolen. Residential school hasn't been... It isn't gone. It's been replaced by the welfare system. Our women are labeled. The whole destruction of family. The government recognized Indigenous women's autonomy in the communities, and they became the target right from that day to right to today, because the women are the ones that hold the families together. So where do we go from here? You want the truth? We are speaking the truth. Where you want reconciliation? We can reconciliate till we're blue in the face, but we can't just do this just on our side. Society needs to change their attitude and belief about who the Indigenous people are, because it's been layers and layers, years and years of labeling and making us look bad and feeding there was this Hollywood image that the Native people were all killed off. You want to talk about reconciliation, you know, the churches should all reverse everything that was done when they put the residential school in. And for every residential school that was put in place, if you're going to talk about reconciliation, you need to build these cultural centers where people can move back towards their roots, where they can start learning their language, their culture, and wear their regalias, and learn, honor each other's, respect each other's. But also, too, society needs to do that to us, too. Thank you.
This documentary is a project of the National Community Radio Association. It is made possible through the support of the Red Jam Slam Society. It is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. There's a national crises line should any listeners be triggered by what they hear on this program today. The number is 1-866-925-4419.
So that concludes this week's edition of Grey Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation. Till then.
The Association des Services de Réhabilitation Sociale du Québec is filing a class action suit. If you were strip searched between July 13th, 2006 and July 1st...
Good evening and welcome to the October 14th edition of Drama Text. Tonight on the show we have two poets, Joy Harjo, who we heard last week, and Alexis Sherman. It's a show that we broadcast about a year ago. So here it is. Hope you enjoy it.
I'm going to start out with a piece, a prayer actually, written for a memorial for Audre Lorde, one of our finest. It's called Reconciliation. And it comes out of thinking about where we are at the end of the century and where we're going. Because we're all here together at a time of incredible possibility as well as incredible destruction. Reconciliation. One. We gather at the shore of all knowledge as peoples who were put here by a God who wanted relatives. This God was lonely for touch and imagined herself as a woman with children to suckle, to sing with, to continue the web of the terrifyingly beautiful cosmos of her womb. This God became a father who wished for others to walk beside him in the belly of creation. This God laughed and cried with us as a sister at the sweet tragedy of our predicament.